Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ira Melman. The top U.S. diplomat makes an unannounced stop in Afghanistan. Afghan Foreign Minister Salahuddin Rabbani says his government is making every effort to advance peace and reconciliation, but those efforts will not bear fruit unless the Taliban comes to the negotiating table. He commented Saturday at the bilateral commission meeting with U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, who made an unannounced stop in Kabul during a tour of the Middle East and Asia. Supportive efforts that could lead to the resumption of peace talks between the Afghan government and Taliban is one of the focal points for Kerry, who is also meeting with President Ashraf Ghani and Chief Executive Abdullah Abdullah during his one-day visit to Kabul. The so-called Quadrilateral Coordination Group, consisting of the U.S., Afghanistan, Pakistan, and China, has been trying to get peace talks moving. However, Taliban representatives refused to take part in the meeting that was planned for March. Kerry's trip to Afghanistan is part of a week-long trip to the Middle East and Asia that also includes an unannounced stop did yesterday in Baghdad. Belgian authorities confirmed the arrest of a sixth person Saturday in connection with the March 22nd bombings in Brussels without giving any details. A police raid was conducted Saturday in the central Brussels district of Etterbeek, but it is not clear whether the arrest was made there. In a series of raids Friday, Belgian police arrested five people, including Mohamed Abrini, suspected to be linked with the Brussels attacks on the city's airports and on a metro station. Belgian investigators are trying to establish if the 31-year-old Abrini of Belgium from Morocco is the third man dubbed the man in the hat. This is VOA News. Protesters in London Saturday called on Prime Minister David Cameron to resign after his family's financial affairs were included in the so-called Panama Papers. Gathered on Downing Street, where the Prime Minister's residence is located, protesters held signs reading, "Time to go, chum," and "Defy Tory rule," among others, chanting, "What do we want? Cameron out and get the Tories out." Speaking at his Conservative Party's spring forum earlier Saturday, Cameron said he should have handled scrutiny of his family's tax arrangements better and promised to learn the lessons. He said it was his responsibility and that Downing Street staff should not be blamed.
"I know that I should have handled this better. I could have handled this better. I know there are lessons to learn and I will learn them. And don't blame number 10 Downing Street or nameless advisors. Blame me.
Cameron's
and I will learn the lessons."
Cameron's admission came several days after negative media coverage and calls for his resignation. The opposition Labour Party has also demanded Cameron make a statement to Parliament Monday regarding his financial affairs linked to offshore investments. Djibouti's Minister of the Interior has announced that President Ismaïl Omar Guelleh has won Friday's presidential election with nearly 87% of the vote. Interior Ministry Hassan Omar Mohamed told VOA's Somali service the vote count is complete and President Guelleh has won outright in the first round of the election, giving him another five-year term in office, his fourth consecutive term since 1999. His nearest rival was Omar Elmi Kaer of the Union for National Salvation, who got just over 7% of the vote. Some opposition parties boycotted the election after the president, who was always the clear front-runner, went back on his earlier decision not to run. Opposition supporters dispute the vote, saying some voters were turned away from polling stations. Opposition leaders have complained of police brutality in the weeks leading up to the election and say the media covers them unfairly. Rock musician Bruce Springsteen has canceled a concert scheduled for Sunday in the U.S. state of North Carolina, citing as the reason the state's new law blocking anti-discrimination measures for transgender people. Springsteen, a beloved U.S. performer whose concerts regularly sell out huge sports arenas, released a statement Friday on social media saying some things are more important than a rock show, and this fight against prejudice and bigotry, which is happening as I write, is one of them. It's the strongest means I have for raising my voice in opposition. I'm Ira Melman.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
You would recall, for quite some time in the previous administration, our relations between these two countries, neighboring countries, had been a little bit frosty.
Tanzania opens warm diplomatic relations with neighboring Rwanda.
We are importing more cash for the, to meet the demand. Unfortunately, it's not overnight to be received in Zimbabwe. There's a little time between placing an order and receiving.
The Zimbabwean economy experiences a cash crunch.
This is evil and a threat to the most fundamental human rights in our constitution. Let me assure you that government is taking serious steps against this criminal behavior and will overcome this.
And the Malawian police search for a one-year-old girl taken from her home last week. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. A new chapter of warm relations has opened between the governments of Tanzania and Rwanda after Tanzanian President John Magufuli officially participated in the 22-year remembrance of the 1994 genocide in Rwanda. Tanzanian Foreign Minister Augustine Mahiga says the administrations in Dodoma and Kigali have had frosty diplomatic relations since a disagreement between President Paul Kagame and former Tanzanian President Jakaya Kikwete. Mahiga told me that the new warm relations will see a sharp improvement in bilateral relations between the two neighboring countries.
A new chapter has been opened between these two countries. You would recall for quite some time, in the previous administration, our relations between these two countries, neighboring countries, had been a little bit frosty over different interpretations on the elements that are destabilizing the region and continue to be a threat to Rwanda, that is the FDLR. And I think that threw us, our relations, in some kind of a spin for a good part of the last fourth government. But this time, I think relations have become extremely warm and a new chapter has been opened. And there's been tremendous exchange of goodwill and assurances from both sides. And I think we are on a totally different trajectory in terms of relations between Tanzania and Rwanda.
From your perspective, with the trip or the visit of President John Magufuli to his compatriot and colleague, President Paul Kagame, boost bilateral relations between the two countries, and how will that enhance the free movement of goods and services as well as human beings?
Well, it should be also understood that Tanzania is the current chair of the East African Community, but also it is a neighbor of Rwanda, and Rwanda's goods go through Dar es Salaam. Up to about 75% of their imports and exports go through the port of Dar es Salaam. So both sides are really important trading partners, and there is a historical relationship between the two countries. So it's important that we maintain goodwill, political understanding between the leaders of the two countries and between the people of the two countries. And at this time, what brought this visit had precisely to do with the trade and economic relations between the two countries from a bilateral perspective, but also in the context of the East African Community. President Magufuli was on holiday in his hometown of Chato, which is less than 200 kilometers from the Rwanda border. And when President Kagame extended an invitation, there are two important functions that had to be performed related to the trade in East Africa and the bilateral relations. One was the inauguration of the one-stop border for transit traffic, especially road traffic, between the two countries at the border called Rusumo. And the other one was the inauguration of a very modern bridge, the Rusumo Bridge, which has a capacity that is about 10 times bigger than the existing bridge that was there before. So these functions had to be performed. The question was, when would this be performed? It just happened at the time when the president was on leave, and the president accepted the invitation, knowing very well that this did come at a time when was the eve of the inauguration and as well as the commemoration of the 22nd commemoration of genocide in Rwanda. So it was a fortuitous and a good coincidence that these things happened at the same time when the two leaders exchanged invitations.
As the chair of the East Africa Community, what role do you think Tanzania specifically could play in conjunction with other members of the community to ensure peace and stability and to prevent issues of conflict, particularly in the East Africa sub-region? We could clearly mention South Sudan and the problems they are going through and other parts of the country, terrorism, for example, like Al-Shabaab, creating chaos and creating instability in part of the East Africa community. What role do you think Tanzania can play in this?
Well, it's absolutely important that for economic development and for economic relations and cooperation between the countries of East Africa, there has to be peace and stability. And if there are any conflicts, those conflicts have to be resolved. It is for this reason that, to the extent possible, Tanzania as the chair has to maintain excellent relations in the context of good neighborliness with the neighboring countries, like we have just done with Rwanda, we continue to do with the other neighbors. We have excellent relations with Kenya, with Uganda, with Burundi. And now we have admitted South Sudan into the East African community. Although we don't share a border, but we have a responsibility as the chair of the community to make sure that the current ongoing conflict, particularly in two countries, Burundi and South Sudan, go through a process of reconciliation and a resolution as quickly as possible. You have mentioned about Al-Shabaab or international terrorism. This is a regional threat and an international threat as well. At the moment, our colleagues in Kenya have been the victims of the expanding ideological and the strategic expansion of international terrorism through the activities of the Al-Shabaab. And by very definition of the ideology, we expect this kind of international terrorism to touch on other countries in the region. There is a standing protocol between the countries of East Africa to enhance regional cooperation and in the area of security. And Tanzania, as the current chair, is really determined to see that the implementation of this protocol gets enhancement. Just 2 weeks ago, I was in Nairobi for the joint military exercises of the five countries. And one of the items in these joint military exercises was to respond to a possible terrorist attacks and threats in any of the two member countries or in more than one country.
Augustine Mahiga is the Tanzanian foreign minister. He spoke with me from the commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. The Zimbabwean Central Bank governor says the financial services sector imported $216 million between January and April this year. This in a bid to ease cash shortages, but has yet to improve the situation. For VOA reporter Evan Chofera has more from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
John Manguya, who was called by the Parliament's Finance Committee to explain the current cash shortages in the country, said that the central bank imported $145 million between January and April this year, while six banks imported $118 million during the same period. Manguya said only six banks, down from 10 last year, had imported money, with the Stanbic Bank accounting for the bulk of the money at $45 million. He said the central bank is taking a number of measures to improve cash problems in the country, including the use of plastic money to reduce the pressure on cash supplies.
So we are importing more cash to meet the demand. But unfortunately, it's not overnight to be received in Zimbabwe. There's a lead time between placing an order and receiving of the foreign exchange. It can take a week from ordering to utilization.
Apart from importing cash, Manguja said there was need to boost production and craft policies that attract foreign direct investment. He added that the opening of the tobacco marketing season would improve the cash situation. He said the high cash demand was largely caused by the payment of civil servants' bonuses, the importation of maize owing to the El Nino weather phenomenon, and withdrawal of huge amounts of cash for speculative purposes due to lack of confidence in the banking sector. Manguja noted that Zimbabweans are no longer keeping money in banks due to high bank charges and failure to pay meaningful interest on deposits. Current cash shortages have seen banks limiting cash withdrawals to as low as $50 per day as banks try to ration cash among their customers. Asked why the Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe cannot revert to the use of the Zimbabwean dollar, which it can easily control, Manguja said that was out of question.
We agree with you about lower currency, but not now. Because we don't have, we haven't satisfied the conditions which we do believe are necessary for us to proceed with the low currency.
Zimbabwe's import bill stands at $7 billion against a $3 billion export bill, and Manguja said this could be rectified by boosting production and exports. The country's major foreign currency earners are tobacco, gold, platinum, diamond, and diaspora remittances. This is Ivan Chifera.
As Kenya Bank's woes continue, the Inspector General of Police has ordered the arrest of six National Bank of Kenya and two Chase Bank senior officials for unethical conduct at the institutions. Chase Bank was Thursday placed under receivership to protect its depositors, creditors, and the public, while National Bank of Kenya's underperformance has been exposed by billions of losses reported in the past financial year. Isaac Ongiri is a senior political reporter with the Kenyan newspaper The Daily Nation. My colleague Douglas Impuga reached him in Nairobi for more on the story.
The Inspector General of Police, Mr. Boynet, gave an order to have directors of the Chase Bank and the chief executive officer and several other top officials of the National Bank arrested over financial issues related to the bank. I'm not quite sure whether these arrests have been effected, but police were out looking for them.
How big are these banks in the Kenyan economy?
The National Bank is actually a big bank. It's a multi-billion bank that has been profit-making for years. Of course, the bank previously in the 90s had issues during the KANU era. But during the Kibaki regime, it had improved quite a bit and was back to profit-making. Chase Bank is not all that big, but it has huge branches and so many customers in Nairobi and major cities around the country. But it's not as big as the National Bank, which has registered major losses this year.
It's being reported that Chase Bank depositors can't access their money. Is this true? And if so, is this the reason the police have had to move in?
It is correct that yesterday the central bank announced that the Chase Bank is now under receivership. And early morning, you know, when customers were coming to visit the bank, they found notices in the entrances of various branches, notifying them that the bank has been closed until further notice. And we've had people complaining, the depositors have been worried. But earlier before that, you know, there was a panic withdrawal from among some customers who had gotten wind of what was going on. And it was due to that probably that even the central bank decided to react so that to avoid a run on Chase Bank.
The police is cautioning people not to spread unsubstantiated claims about the banking sector. Do you think this could be a bigger problem among other banks as well?
There are rumors to that effect that, of course, there are banks with problems here and there, the National Bank being one of them. But, you know, what is happening at the National Bank is only that they have registered a major loss this year, something that has caused panic. But what we hear from inside the bank sources is that despite having registered a loss, which is normal, the bank is stable. Of course, the bank has also had issues here and there that have actually been under investigation by the authorities, but it is running. I'm not quite sure whether information that has been circulating in social media could have maybe have caused some effects or people to try to behave in a manner similar to how some of the customers of Chase Bank behaved before Central Bank decided to take action.
Isaac Ongiri is a senior political reporter with the Kenyan newspaper The Daily Nation. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Mpoga from Nairobi. In Malawi, police are searching for a one-year-old girl taken from her home last week. The girl is the latest victim in a wave of abductions and attacks targeting albinos, whose body parts are highly sought after on the regional black market. The threat has become so acute that Malawi's president gave a national address this month pledging action. For VOA, Lamek Masina reports from the Malawian commercial capital, Blantyre.
In central Malawi, a mother woke to find that her baby daughter had been snatched from her side during the night. Edi Nanzingwi is the police spokesperson for Kasungu District.
So she shouted for help when the neighbors came. They tried to search for baby, but they could not trace her.
The spokeswoman told VOA that two suspects have been arrested, including the baby's father. She said investigations continue and the baby is still missing. The abduction came a month after a nine-year-old albino boy was found beheaded in eastern Malawi. Earlier this year, President Peter Mutharika addressed the nation.
This is evil and a threat to the most fundamental human rights in our constitution. Let me assure you that government is taking serious steps against this criminal behavior and will overcome this. We have intensified surveillance and investigations in the affected districts and the country as a whole.
Mutharika called specifically on the judiciary to issue stiffer penalties to the culprits. People with albinism and absence of pigment in their skin, hair and eyes are targeted in Malawi and other parts of Africa because many people falsely believe that potions made from their body parts will bring good luck and wealth. Those involved are not often found or prosecuted, and when they are, the penalties are often criticized as too lenient. Last year, a court in southern Malawi ordered a man found with albino body parts to pay a fine of $30. He was charged with possessing human tissue, which carries a maximum sentence of 3 years in jail. Police have recorded at least 50 attacks on albinos in the past 3 years. The attacks have sparked both outrage and fear. Ian Simbota is a journalist with albinism working for the state-run Malawi Broadcasting Corporation.
When I am even working late, I always think of my life when I go out. I always think of what will I do if I come in such kind of situation. So it's like you're living in somebody's country, yet you're a citizen.
The majority of attacks on albinos have been in Machinga District near the border with Mozambique, where the body parts are reportedly being sold to witch doctors. In 2015, the government created a task force composed of police, traditional and religious leaders, and a local albino association to address the attacks. The strategy was to identify the homes and schools of people with albinism and check in on them regularly. However, the president of the Association of People with Albinism in Malawi, Boniface Massa, says the task force no longer functions due to lack of funding.
And as a result of the task force being dormant, and that's what has led to the restart of the attacks on people with albinism. All what we are saying is the political will, the effort by the police must really translate in the actual ending of the attacks.
Massa says Malawi should follow Tanzania's lead and ban witch doctors as a way to cut off demand for human body parts. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
International law prohibits torture under all circumstances without exception. Yet torture remains widespread throughout every region in the world. Anyone and everyone could be a victim. A group of experts, including specialized doctors, psychiatrists, and lawyers, met at the United Nations in Geneva to exchange views on how to stop torture and how to tackle the long-lasting suffering of torture victims, particularly that of children and adolescents. For VOA, Lisa Schlein reports.
The occasion for this expert gathering is to mark the 35th anniversary of the United Nations Voluntary Fund for Victims of Torture. The fund directly assists around 50,000 victims of torture and their family members every year. It says the victims who turn up for treatment include an increasing number of children and adolescents. Figures show organizations supported by the fund this year have helped 5,279 child and adolescent victims of torture. This is over one quarter more than were assisted in 2015. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Zeid Ra'ad Al Hussein is shocked by these numbers and by the unspeakable pain and suffering even very young children are forced to endure.
The torture of children is an unbearable reality, particularly in countries in conflicts such as Syria. Indeed, children are often targeted because they are children as a way of intimidating entire communities or to leverage additional pain onto their parents.
Sana Hamza is founder of Restart, a center for rehabilitation of victims of torture and violence in Lebanon. She says she works with refugee children from Syria and other Middle Eastern countries in conflict. She says she has intimate knowledge of the scars of abuse and pain they bear from torture. She speaks through an interpreter.
Is it acceptable to allow a child see his mother be raped or his father be beaten up? Is it acceptable to allow a child hear the screams of pain of his brothers and sisters in the neighbouring cell? Is it acceptable that the whole world looks on and does not act, although they know perfectly well what is happening to these children?
Hamza says these young people who are victims of human terror come to therapy sessions gripped by huge physical and mental suffering. She says her role is to help them to speak out. As a therapist, she says she tries to get these young victims to break their silence. But speaking through an interpreter, she notes this is very difficult to do.
We hear descriptions of untold brutality, psychological violence, of unfathomable cruelty. Let it be known, ladies and gentlemen, that I do not walk away unscathed from my interviews, that the bruises on my soul are increasingly numerous.
The type of torture seen in the Middle East is repeated throughout the world. Paul Oriani works as a clinical advisor for mental health for the U.S.-based Center for Victims of Torture. The center assists torture victims in the Middle East and helps vast numbers in African countries. These include Kenya, Democratic Republic of Congo, Rwanda, Burundi, Somalia, Northeast Ethiopia, Uganda, and South Sudan. Oriani says torture is complex and multi-layered.
If you look across these places where we work, the issues range from, say, Iraqi and Syrian children who are primary and secondary torture survivors in Jordan, to Great Lakes teenagers in Nairobi who are themselves torture survivors but have to take parental roles from their parents who are sometimes more adversely affected by the torture and are no longer functional.
The UN Voluntary Fund for Victims of Torture and global networks of physicians, psychologists, social workers, and lawyers work tirelessly and with some success in rehabilitating children and adult victims of torture. They help many of the survivors heal and reclaim their lives and rights. The experts say states have an obligation to help child victims of torture recover and to be recompensed for their suffering. They agree rehabilitation is important, but so is justice. They say torturers must be prosecuted and held accountable for their crimes. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. And right now it's time for music from our African collection. Enjoy what we have for you.
Baby, so sweet. I drink a down one by the man. Baby, so fine. Who could para? You don't know. Are you ready now? Bring your children.
Come on. Mami, you're too classy. Bimba, you are married. Go. Obi Antone Collection. Yeah, be Obi Antone Collection.
What else?
For day.
Huh?
Obi Antone Collection.
With.
Obi Antone Collection.
Aba.
Obi Antone Collection. Go.
Yeah. Memma wo nipe biembu wa bonfia. I hope a promo yenye na buhuntia. Oya wo town for jano manimbia. Yambu amu amunsi na bumpia. Go.
Se upe mu anyo menyi na edi. Na na nyame ni ya wakano ne bebe mo. Se uma usa swabi ponyi ne tutu. So my party don't lose God. Kan wako madoye. Everybody sing it, hallelujah.
Yeah.
Hallelujah. Everybody sing it, hallelujah. Hallelujah.
Happy
single. Oh, yeah. I say happy single. Oh, yeah.
Namu fisa meshiasi. Le koya masamba. Che. I want you to kakira me fe munti ne wamo se ma wai mini dama. We need a wono. Namu fisa me yesanseni. Che. Uhumiana wo ye masho afede weni bome so pena wo se hwan poni na nanya menen sa no afede wo humi tutu mana mo se me ye jonki ne sabusu bu kebi same on you too afede me hu se me makobole yonki cheno kene ne mo se monkey if I check I dey say you dey hungry why ye yanka wo da so sha boski mi wu ye de nanya meti ase woni menye pe wo bia ne ne vi ase mana me da bent so wa flower no wo bia for handkerchief from the pemeni ase
wo pe mo an yo menyi na edi
what else
nana nyame ni awa kanu ne bebe mo we wo ma usa swa bi ponyi na tutu. So my party don't lose God, can't walk for my door, yeah. Everybody sing it, hallelujah. Hallelujah. Everybody sing it, hallelujah. Hallelujah. Make me sing, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I say, make me sing, oh, yeah.
My win chin me 10 years, me wank a way back. My flop it, this be my payback. My enemies see for day God, me care so, I don't want to disobey God. No. My try some of them me back to prison. Wa bra mo ni particular reason. Mo dwe me ho, me need to go for your meeting. Fatu wasum, I don't want to be repeating. Ya me na ebo me ho ban ti mo nye foko. Money no be problem, ya no ni me moto. To when you hear me ho na me ni, ni me shot to. Me mo be ninja, watch na me ya don't know.
Una wo boss run as as in e mo nya menti na ya frawo Adonai.
And that was Music from the Continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and engineer for today, Xiaogang Chang, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. I remember, as the elders say, a fully grown-up tree cannot be bent into a walking stick. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Sudan has one of the highest rates of malnutrition in the world. In addition to widespread chronic undernutrition, approximately 2 million children in Sudan are acutely malnourished due to ongoing insecurity and the resultant widespread displacement and reduced access to agricultural lands. High levels of acute food insecurity persist in Darfur, South Kordofan, and Blue Nile. To help save lives, reduce food insecurity, and stabilize nutrition rates, the U.S. Agency for International Development announced that it has provided nearly $68 million in emergency food assistance to Sudan. Since 2011, USAID has provided over $1 billion in food and nutrition assistance to the people of Sudan. USAID assistance will reach approximately 2.5 million Sudanese, as well as refugees from South Sudan and other neighboring countries. This aid will be delivered through the World Food Program, which will help address the complex emergency arising from conflict, natural disasters, and widespread displacement in Sudan, including those severely affected by the impacts of the weather pattern known as El Niño. In an effort to address the malnutrition rate in Sudan, which is the third highest in the world, USAID will provide fortified foods for malnourished children under age 5 and pregnant or lactating women, emergency school feeding programs and food distributions to the most vulnerable and food insecure populations. The strong El Niño drought effects have caused below-average plantings and harvests of staple and cash crops across Sudan, all of which will lead to higher demand for food in 2016. Humanitarian assistance needs will also be higher than usual, as the 2016 lean season began in March, 2 months earlier than usual. The projected number of acutely food-insecure people in Sudan is likely to reach 4.5 million during the peak lean season in 2016. Protracted conflict inside Sudan and in neighboring countries has increased the number of refugees and internally displaced people suffering from food insecurity in Sudan. Over 360,000 refugees reside in Sudan. Since December 2013, over 190,000 South Sudanese have arrived, fleeing violence in their country. Ongoing fighting in Darfur has displaced a total of 2.6 million people. Another 1.7 million are displaced by conflict in South Kordofan and Blue Nile states. As the largest international donor of humanitarian aid in Sudan, the United States is clearly committed to the well-being of the Sudanese people and generously provides needs-based assistance to all accessible areas and populations, including displaced and otherwise conflict-affected people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.